Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast, coming from Dallas, Texas and Sacramento, California. Here's Skylar Teo and David Stauffer.
All right. Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast. We are back with what seems to be another two-week hiatus, although less intentional. I guess I should start off the pod by giving a little background to how the podcast is going to be moving forward. But you'll notice our posting schedule has been somewhat sporadic, and that has quite a bit to do with both Skylar and Skylar and I's busy schedules. So, I mean, also with my frequent humanitarian aid trips to Africa, makes things difficult sometimes to record. And so Skylar and I talked about it, and one goal we have for this podcast is to release an episode every single week, so there's some consistency. And I think it's an achievable goal, but it's difficult considering two busy schedules. So the way we're going to go moving forward is sometimes it's going to be Skylar and I, you know, probably more than half the time. And then other times it's going to be Skylar and a guest host, or it'll be myself and a guest host. And so we'll start to bring more people in, generally people whose movies opinions we trust and we think could be fun and enjoyable on the podcast. And so that'll happen from time to time. And so this podcast actually will be the first one with a guest host. So coming from Los Angeles, California, is my friend, my buddy, Aaron Alvarado. So,
hello, Brave Little Podcast listeners. To the millions and the millions. It's great to be here. So, thanks, David. I appreciate the invite. And thank you to Skylar for keeping my seat warm. I appreciate that, too. Now that we can push him out of the way, and let's get our show rolling.
Yeah, we just want to... Just want to say thank you to Skylar. I mean, he was,
He was great, man.
He was great.
Enjoy your time on that other podcast that will remain nameless.
No, I think the best way to look at this is Skylar's been a really good, he's been a good starting pitcher, but it's time to bring in the closer.
Oh, yeah, I think he's like training wheels. So now that you've taken the training wheels off. What your listeners don't actually know is you and I, did record one episode of a podcast about 7 years ago at this point, maybe eight.
No, longer. Was longer. It? So, yeah. So let's think. So I, yeah. Because I left on a 2-year Mormon mission in 2006, okay. And it was before then. So we're talking 10, 11 years.
So we were on the cutting edge. And
yes.
Whatever happened to our
that we recorded an ep. Yeah, it was called DNA Radio, and we went to my buddy's house in Folsom, California, to record because he was a musician and he had a setup, and you and I recorded a whole episode of our show. Don't remember what we talked
about.
Don't
remember either. And I'd actually prefer not to listen to that ever again.
I'm glad you reminded me. Yeah. I think I might actually text that friend and see if there's somehow I can get a copy of that file. I want to give a little background actually to how Aaron and I know each other since he's obviously based in Los Angeles and I have never lived there.
Yet. There's still
time. I probably met you when I was 14 years old, 14, maybe 15.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that I ordered a burrito from you. Was that where you were working at Taco Bell at the time? I think you were working at Taco Bell.
Yeah, when I was 15. Yeah. So when I was 15 years old, I worked at Taco Bell next door, right directly next door to the local movie theater in a suburb of Sacramento called Folsom. And Aaron would come in and get his bean burritos, no beans. And
extra onions. Yeah.
And then when I turned 16, because the theaters didn't hire anyone below the age of 16, wisely, I turned 16 and then I jumped over to the movie theater and applied for a job, miraculously got it, it might have something to do with the fact that all of my older siblings had worked there.
Right. I think I was already managing at that point at the movie theater.
You were a manager. Yeah.
And I remember I worked with your sister and she was awesome. And then she's like, my little brother wants to work here. And I said, why? What's wrong with him?
for you, and you got to imagine as a 15-year-old, the idea of working at a movie theater where you can watch as many movies as you want for free, in addition to unlimited free ICs, was basically heaven,
oh,
right?
Yeah. I
was
in like, theory, well, in theory, it's
yeah,
a dream.
Yeah, to think like I will be at age 16, I will have made it. You know, like I will have essentially peaked. Was, you know, exciting. And so you didn't start off as my manager because I worked in snack bar, right? And then eventually they transferred me to the box office,
which was the worst decision of all time for that company, because
it sure was.
How would you describe my managerial style?
I would say I would describe it as hands off.
I believe in a laissez-faire type of work environment.
I'll never forget. We had a work shift, and it was like I didn't know you that well. I only knew you for your beanless bean burrito orders, and I was like, I don't know if this guy's cool or if he's, you know. And it was in the middle of a weekday, right, where no one sees movies except people over the age of 80. And there's, you know, there's just not that many people, so it's just completely dead, and we're standing in the box office, and little by little we get like more and more comfortable as we're talking, and I remember that work shift ending with just, I was just dying laughing, it didn't take super long before they removed us from ever working shifts again. ever again.
It couldn't have been more than 3 months. I mean, I want to say
no. Yeah.
Something like 60 days, and we were just having
shout out to Celeste Higgins, who was the individual responsible for making sure that Aaron and I never worked a shift together ever again.
Well, I mean, from a company standpoint, it was actually a smart move.
Efficiency is at an all-time low.
I think that I was actually ruining you, so I can't blame him. But working that morning shift, I mean, there's just nothing to do. So you're standing in that box office for hours. And so it makes all the difference in the world who you're paired in there with. So anytime I got the chance to work with David, I mean, I actually showed up to work on time those days. So... It's very rare.
Well, it was great because, you know, I was a high school kid, you know, I remember specifically you had opened up my eyes to the world of stand-up comedy. Now, I'll say this much: when we look back upon Dane Cook, it's a name that causes a lot of like. Emotion of being like, that guy's a hack. He steals jokes. His personality is very grating and annoying. And all of those things are probably true. But I will say for him that his album Harmful of Swallowed definitely opened up a generation's eyes to stand-up comedy. And so at the very least, he did that.
There's no doubt. He was a phenomenon. He was a tidal wave.
Yeah.
I mean, he transcended the medium without a doubt. I mean, you know, say what you will if you think the guy's funny or not or whatever. I personally am not a fan anymore, but at the time, I thought he was pretty funny. You know, what did I know?
Oh, yeah.
But
my buddies and I would listen to that CD. You know, this is before, and then you know, his next album, Retaliation, is enormous, and that really. Then he also had all his HBO specials and whatever.
And the tipping point happened. But Harmful, and he capsized, and
yes, then it capsized bad. But his album Harmful of Swallow, my buddies and I would listen to that in the car. I mean, on repeat, we'd sit in the car and just be dying laughing at his bits about Kool-Aid and Nesquik or whatever. And like, I mean, it was the funniest thing. And I remember, you know, talking to you about it. And at this point, you were very much involved in stand-up comedy, and maybe you still are. But like, you were very much involved about the kind of the players in stand-up comedy at that time. And I remember it was almost like this, like, acknowledgement of, you know, I'm glad you found a stand-up you like. Now let me show you some real stand-up. And you literally drove me to San Francisco to the Punchline, an iconic comedy venue. You drove me to the Punchline in San Francisco to see Patrice O'Neill.
You know, the funny part was we didn't tell your parents, and you were 17. So I'm pretty sure I could have ended up in jail. But
So, well, the funny thing about Patrice O'Neill, and for those of you who don't know who that is, was kind of maybe this is a cliche term, but he seems to be a comics comic. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was very, 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 very popular within comic circles, and he was big among fans of stand-up comedy, and he was just on the verge of what I think was probably an enormous breakout.
Oh, yeah.
Before he passed away way, way, way before his time.
Yeah, it's true.
But
I think his most memorable for playing he was in the TV show, I'm drawing a blank right now.
The Office.
The Office and the other one, Arrested Development. He worked in the banana stand.
Oh, yeah. He worked at the banana stand in Arrested Development. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah. So, I mean,
he was a warehouse worker.
Exactly.
On the Office.
Replaced by the guy, Craig Robinson, Daryl.
Craig Robinson. Yeah. Yeah. So what's interesting about you taking me to this comedy show was that not only was it my first experience of stand-up comedy, but it was my first experience seeing a kind of a master at work, because he does crowd work, right? And I don't think I was prepared to witness what I saw, because what's funny is I don't even remember laughing. In fact, I remember being with another guy there, a friend of yours, that even remarked afterwards, said something to me to the effect of like, what the heck, why weren't you laughing? And I didn't really know what to say to the guy, because I distinctly remember watching Patrice O'Neill completely destroy this woman sitting in the audience. Unlike anything I'd ever seen before. Like, I'd never seen the barrage of insults and just ripped her apart. And I remember sitting there like, what? Like, this woman purchased a ticket to see you. You just killed her. You killed her. And she's sitting next to this guy who's not doing anything. Like, he's not even trying to defend her. Like the insults were so vile that, like, I remember just sitting there being like, knowing that I'm watching someone who's at the top of their craft, who's a master at their craft.
Untouchable.
Just execute. Yeah. Like, just execute at 1,000%.
Yeah.
And he did this to a few people in the crowd. And to the point that I'm not laughing. I'm jaw dropped. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, well, on face value, that sounds terrible. And you would think, why would anyone go see a comic like this? But in the moment... he was just so on point with his comedy. I mean, the worst possible thing, by the way, is if that lady's boyfriend or husband or whatever tried to defend her. Oh my God.
Oh, yeah.
He would have been eviscerated. So yeah, you just have to take one, and you have to understand that, you know?
Yeah. Well, so, and I knew that, right? Watching it, I was like, well, of course the guy's not going to say anything because he knows he's going to get killed.
Yeah.
It's like, and I'm sitting there, and there's like a little bit of me, just a tiny bit of me that's like, what if I'm next? like, I'm the 17-year-old white kid, like skinny white kid who's not laughing, right? And I'm thinking like, I might be a target here.
right. Well, for anyone that doesn't know Patrice, I mean, he was 6'5", probably 350, 360 pounds. So a very large, intimidating black man.
Yeah.
But once you hear him speak... he's not malicious. I mean, yes, he'll say mean things to people, but most of the time it's because they do something to set him off, whether that's groan at a punchline. That's one thing that he absolutely loathed. You don't groan at a punchline. So, yeah, I mean, you know, he would find a reason to just shut some people down. But, I mean, he really was a master of the craft, and he's one of the very few people, one of the very few celebrities that when he died, I actually... felt something for that. So, I mean, I do miss the guy. I think he was, like you said, he was almost on the brink of just finding that next level in his career. And, it's a shame that he died so soon.
Yeah.
But hilarious. Yeah. I mean, he really was my favorite comic of all time. You know, the best.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. The other thing, that makes that show memorable for me was they announced at that show that like the following Monday or Tuesday that Dave Chappelle was doing a series of sold out shows at the Warfield Theater in San Francisco, you know, which is this big theater.
Yeah.
Right? And they said that one of his favorite venues was the Punchline in San Francisco, in that he had agreed to come after the show at the Warfield to do some stand-up mm-hmm. at the Punchline, and that it would be a first come, first serve, get in line ordeal. Now, this is during the peak of Chappelle's show mm-hmm. on Comedy Central, right? And so he's maybe the biggest comic
world at that time? Without a doubt. He was the premier comic, the name above all names at that time.
Totally. So to hear, like, wait a second, I can see Chappelle in this room. And the Punchline is a very small room.
Tiny.
Like, you're very small. So the idea of seeing Chappelle in a venue like that, you know, I tell my buddies, and we're like, oh, we're in. So we go in the morning, we line up, we're probably the 10th people in line.
Dressed as Rick James.
Yes, dressed as Rick James.
All his different characters. Charlie Murphy.
and we get seated at one of the front tables, one of the three front row tables. And I got to see Chappelle.
Very cool.
And Chappelle that was clearly under the influence of... I don't even know what I would guess, but the man had just done two big shows at the Warfield Theater. It comes 10 o'clock, 10:30, something like that, to the Punchline, and he does one of his famous all-nighter shows. So he was up there for nearly 5 hours.
Wow.
But like, what's interesting about that show was he did some stand-up, right? But a lot of it was just talking.
Right.
And he brought up Mo's Def, mm-hmm. and they did some music.
wow.
Yeah. He pulls him out of the crowd. Mo's Def sitting at the table next to me. I don't even see mm-hmm. him. I don't even know he's there. He pulls Mo's Def up on stage, and they do some freestyle. They freestyle to an instrumental track.
Right.
And
so when Mo's Def was up, like, on the stage, did you say, hey, you're from Be Kind Rewind? You didn't even know he was a rapper.
Yeah. I was like... I love the Italian Job.
Dexter season 7 or whatever it was. I don't know.
We did, one of the buddies I was with at the table, we did get reprimanded because I don't remember what he yelled
too
out.
White?
It wasn't anything crazy.
Was he too white for the venue?
But the whitest of my friends. In fact, he wasn't even my friend. He was a guy who'd come along with one of my friends. And he got handled by Dave Chappelle's handlers. Let's just put it that way. Yeah, two guys came up and had some words with him about saying anything at all.
What did he yell out?
It was pretty crazy. But anyway, so that's my long story to how I saw Dave Chappelle at the Punchline in San Francisco. But anyway, thanks for introducing me to good stand-up comedy.
Yeah, man, no problem.
That has totally changed the way I even view or listen or appreciate comedy.
Yeah.
But you were also, so you lived in Sacramento for a time.
Unfortunately, yes,
that's where
I
met you.
I'm just kidding.
It's one, greatest city in America. They don't have that slogan for no reason. No, I believe it's City of Trees. But anyway. But you eventually moved back down. When I was on my mission, you moved back down to L.A.
Yeah.
And
so I'm from L.A. I was born in Long Beach.
Yeah.
Was up in Sacramento for a time, and then I came back to L.A.
And you studied film in school.
Yes.
You are a filmmaker yourself. You've I know you're constantly participating on projects, working on stuff. In fact, I drove down to L.A., mm-hmm. On one summer where we worked on I helped shoot a film that you wrote and directed called Swindle.
That's correct.
And I may or may not link to that in the show notes, as we'll see. I don't even know if I have a link to it.
You might want to just link to the raw footage, because I think I've taken that one offline. off my Vimeo at this point. I came back to LA. I wanted to pursue my dream. Always wanted to be a writer director, and you know, I came back and decided to actually learn some craft, more than just being, you know, a fan of movies, which I am first and foremost. But you know, I wouldn't really call myself a director per se, but I'm learning. You know, I love to tell stories visually, and I think. Maybe hopefully someday I can actually work in the industry and get paid. So that's the dream.
Yeah, you know, I that's it. It's an interesting question, saying you're not, you know, about like when you'd consider yourself a director. I am not a filmmaker necessarily.
I beg to differ.
But I did one short documentary that I submitted to a few film festivals, and I wondered at what point can I call myself a documentary filmmaker? Probably not now, but that didn't stop me from putting that in my Twitter bio. So,
and that's all that matters.
Every time I read it, I think like, yeah, that's not true, but I'm just gonna keep that in there anyway. And if people want to make fun of me, I'm gonna take it because I deserve
it. Well, I do the same thing, and I look at my bio, and I'm like, oh yeah, filmmaker. I guess I'm a filmmaker in the sense that Don Draper was a good dad. Yeah. So I guess in that sense, yeah, I'm a filmmaker or a faithful husband. I mean, in that sense, gosh. Yes, I am definitely a filmmaker.
Well, thanks for joining us at the pod.
Absolutely.
I have a feeling you'll be joining us for several of these. And so, thanks in advance. We talked a lot about different pod ideas, and I had mentioned that a lot of that, I think a lot of people who listen, a fair amount are sports fans as well as film fans. And so when we can merge sports and movies, it usually makes for a pretty good topic. And so you had pitched the idea of doing a top five baseball films. And I think that's great considering a couple things. One, we're coming upon the MLB playoff season here, the playoffs pretty soon. And two, today, I got to witness in the Washington Nationals dugout, Papelbon, a go for the two-handed choke on Bryce Harper. And I watched that thinking like, yeah, the best way to celebrate the Papelbon Harper choke is to do a podcast on the top five baseball movies.
I mean, it makes perfect sense, really. But then again, you know, who hasn't wanted a two-hand choke? Bryce Harper. So that's my contention.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And look, when Zac Efron plays Harper in his biopic, I'm going to love that scene of Papelbon going after the throat. if you guys don't know what I'm talking about, please, I'm sure you do. But if you don't, Google it and watch it because it's pretty incredible. It's pretty incredible.
I actually haven't seen it yet, I can't wait. So,
well, they played it off in the press conference afterwards. It's just, you know, a couple of brothers fighting, which is great. I've got two brothers. I would fight. We fight all the time.
Do you two-hand choke each other?
Not one time did we choke each other with two hands. One hand. My brother did one hand on me once, my older brother, that I recall. Never two hands. So.
Yeah, in my list of movies, there's no two-hand choking, unfortunately. I mean, I had to reconsider after the story came out, but I couldn't find one.
Well, making the list, I don't know about you, but this was like not, I mean, I always say this. Every list we make, I say the exact same thing, which was, this was hard. This wasn't easy. And look, I don't know if life gets much harder than being a podcast host that has to pick the top five movies in a given category. That's a rough life.
Oh, yeah.
That's a tough, you know. When it comes to the real problems of the world, that's the problems you don't want to have. I like that you texted me and asked me a very good question, which kind of set the stage for my criteria. And your question was, does basketball count as a baseball movie?
Well, the more that I think about it, I would say that it's definitely a basketball movie. I mean, it has elements of baseball. But the game, the way the game is played, you're shooting a ball through a hoop. So that makes it a basketball movie.
Which I 100% agree. And so on my basketball list, that officially knocks off the entirely mediocre Glory Road out of the number five spot. So,
I must say, if basketball was considered a baseball movie, it would probably be number two on my list. So.
Okay. Because it would have been number one on mine. I made a big list. I kind of chiseled out the five that I would go with. And then I have a whole bunch of kind of either honorable mention / afterthought picks. And generally we go through those ones first. But I actually think we should start with five. We'll alternate. We'll work our way up to one. And then let's talk about films, certain films that narrowly missed our lists, or ones that maybe people are surprised didn't make it, because there's a few that some people consider like all-timers. And so it might be worth explaining why some films didn't.
Well, if you think about the subject of baseball, I mean, every year there's probably three baseball movies put out.
Correct.
At least. I mean, we're talking major budget baseball films. So there is a very long list of movies to choose from. Most of them are bad, honestly. Most of them are bad, but I'll still watch them. I love a sports movie.
Isn't it amazing, though? Like, you're totally right. Looking at the list of baseball films, there's an art to making baseball work cinematically. And when achieved, I think it makes for some of my favorite movies like of all time. But there's so many more misses than hits.
Kevin Costner starred in most of them.
He starred in a lot of them, and we're going to be talking about that for sure. For sure, but you want to start us off with your number five?
Yeah, so my number five is actually a recent movie. I think it came out in 2011, actually, looking at my notes here, and it's Moneyball. Directed by Bennett Miller, based on the book.
Yeah.
The amazing book, by the way. One of my favorite books.
Oh, yeah.
but the movie itself, Moneyball, I mean, Brad Pitt was fantastic. Jonah Hill was... Yeah. I think it's Jonah Hill's best role to date.
Totally.
I mean, he played the bumbling buffoon assistant GM to a T. And then, you know, he kind of grows into his role, and he blossoms, and you start to root for the guy. I mean...
Yeah.
I just watched it the other day, and it's as good as the first time I watched it. So, I think the writing was on point. Like I said, the performance of Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill. What's his name is Scott Hatterberg. His name escapes me at the moment.
Oh, Chris Pratt.
Yes, Guardians of the Galaxy. Chris Pratt. Yeah. I mean, he was fantastic as Hatterberg. So. The subject matter is not, I'm not an A's fan or anything like that. And, although I do remember at the time, the fervor that was surrounding the team when they went on that streak and, you know, I might've gotten caught up in it for a minute, but, I'm sure that one hits closer to home for you being an A's fan. But the story itself, it's just really interesting. And, you know, the movie took an angle of the, executive. One of the very few times in a movie, you got the perspective of an executive instead of a player. So, and he was the hero. So, I loved Moneyball, number five for me.
Yeah. So, Moneyball is definitely on my list, and it will be getting to a little later in the list.
Okay.
We're starting at number five.
Tipping your hand, I see.
Yeah, certainly am. And for reasons you already mentioned, I'm a big A's fan. You can even see over my shoulder, we're FaceTiming right now, and there's literally a photo of the Oakland Coliseum on my wall, and which is where I've seen countless baseball games with my dad and my brothers.
And
we would go to games.
I noticed you grew out your mustache to emulate Dennis Eckersley. So
I sure did. Not only the mustache, but my throwing motion is definitely like X. So... Oh man, I own a Dennis Eckersley jersey? I do.
Several.
I'll jump more into that when I get to Moneyball. And but great pick at number five. My number five is one that's probably more controversial in the sense of, is this a baseball movie? There's enough baseball in this film for me to consider it a baseball movie. And yeah, this is maybe me being a little bit cute by picking something that's pretty abstract. But judging by all the other options, I feel pretty good about this because I really loved this movie as a kid. It came out in 1985, and it stars one of the greatest comics of all time, Richard Pryor, and it's Brewster's Millions. For those who haven't seen Brewster's Millions, it is a movie.
What? I've never seen it. I've seen it on lists.
You've never seen?
I've never actually taken the time to watch it. So please tell me what's it all about.
So Richard Pryor plays an aging minor league baseball player, right? And he's, you know, I believe it takes place in Chicago. And essentially, baseball is a big part of the film, you know, just because of his kind of where he's at in his life. It's his profession. and it's what he loves. But the film itself is about him getting this inheritance from some sort of long lost uncle or whatever it is.
Doesn't sound too convoluted at all.
No. But he's given like he's in, and I don't remember the numbers. I have not seen it recently, but it's essentially like the premise is he's going to get like this $300 million fortune. Mm-hmm. If he can spend, it's something like $30,000 a day or a certain amount of millions per week over this extended period of time. He literally has to spend a certain amount of money in order to get the money, right?
Okay.
Which is like the most American thing I can even think of. And I know I'm screwing up the plot, and I apologize for those who are probably greater Brewster's Millions mm-hmm. fans than I am. I just know I loved the idea as a kid of having to spend money in order to get money. But so it's this guy who's not used to living extravagantly, trying to spend, and he's not allowed to have a cent left, okay. essentially. Like, he has to spend X amount of dollars in 30 days, mm-hmm. and if he has a cent left, he doesn't get any of the trust, right? If he successfully spends it all without having anything left, right? Like, he can't buy a bunch of stuff. Like, he can't buy a bunch of houses, and then that's it. Mm-hmm. Like, he has to spend and then not have anything left over. So that's the plot of the film, right. But baseball plays a big role in it. And Richard Pryor... Like, if, for those who aren't as familiar with Richard Pryor because they died a while ago, this is a pretty good, like, kind of entry into getting to know him as a comic and as a movie star. Mm-hmm. Certainly not his greatest work. His work as a stand-up clearly is where he's best on display. But yeah, check out Brewster's Millions.
One of the things about Pryor is he really didn't get a chance to – I mean, he never had a vehicle as far as movies go that – really conveyed how funny he was, how timely he was as a comic. I mean,
yeah,
he was just in a lot of bad movies. That's the only way to put it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of Gene Wilder, though, which is. But, all right, what's your number four?
My number four, okay. Bear with me for just a second here. Number four, I have the seminal Rookie of the Year, 1993.
Wow.
Starring Thomas Ian Nicholas, Gary Busey, Daniel Stern, to name a few. Yeah.
Yes.
So this one is so high on my list purely for nostalgia. I mean, this is one of those movies that I saw when I was a kid, and I bothered my parents, my mom, to buy it for me on VHS tape, and I watched the thing constantly, like on an endless loop. That thing was just in the VCR at all times. I've seen it way, way, way too many times. And anytime that it's on cable now, it just makes me feel like I'm a kid again for 90 minutes or whatever it is. The movie itself is terrible, honestly. It's so stupid. The whole plot is there's a kid who is a huge Cubs fan. He's a loser in school, has just these two loser friends, until one day he falls, breaks his arm. The ligaments heal up to where it stiffens up and he can now throw 95 miles an hour. And so somehow he throws a ball. I think he catches a ball in the outfield and he throws it back into the infield. And everyone recognizes that this kid has just a cannon. And so the Cubs decide to make the Cubs decide that he should be their closing pitcher. A 13-year-old kid, obviously, makes tons of sense. And the movie itself is terrible. Daniel Stern, hilarious as this kind of like babysitter. Gary Busey plays the love interest. Gary Busey is the old veteran pitcher who's on his last legs, mm-hmm. Who falls in love with Henry, who's the kid, Henry's mom, you know, it's just
it's a little bit like. Like, Busey is a little bit like the Papelbon.
Less choky than Papelbon, but yes. And, you know, it's just a feel-good story, and it's family fun for all ages. But, yeah, there's some really funny moments. It's corny and cheesy at the same time, but for me, it just stands out as one of my top five favorite baseball movies.
You know, and nostalgia isn't a bad reason to put something on your list. Rookie of the Year isn't on my mm-hmm. list, but I'm really glad it made yours so we could talk about mm-hmm. it. Because this is how much of an effect that film had on me. Is in the sixth grade.
You tried to break your arm?
I broke my wrist.
Oh,
I broke my wrist. Yeah. I was riding a go-kart and I tried to go on this jump and I ended up turning it on the side and I broke my wrist. Mm-hmm. And this is how terrible, or not even terrible, maybe more amazing it is. I was beyond pumped when I found out that it was broken and that I had to get a cast on it, because I literally thought like, this is my moment, because when this cast is coming off, I'm pitching 100 miles an hour. I firmly believed that there was a chance. Like, I was like, nah, yeah, there's a chance, maybe not a good one, but there's a chance that like I'm gonna be able to pitch when this cast comes off. Didn't turn out quite as I expected it to.
Wait, you didn't get signed by the River Cast?
Slower.
You had to switch arms because you're horribly disfigured now.
Yeah, I didn't take into account that I broke my left wrist and I'm right-handed, and so I guess it doesn't change the fact that I'm not pitching left-handed. Wasn't gonna work. But yeah, man, I really did. I really loved that movie, and the fact that, you know, you can call the movie stupid, mm-hmm. but if Gary Busey picked it, that adds some legitimacy, right?
I mean, honestly, he destroys it in the role of what was his name? Oh, Chet Stedman. That's right. So he
Stedman.
Yeah. He was fantastic in that role. I mean, from a baseball perspective, none of the stuff makes sense. Like, they're pitching him on multiple days. They take him out of a game at one point, and they're going to put him back in. It's just like, it doesn't follow any of the rules of baseball, but it doesn't matter in this universe, I guess. I don't know.
No, doesn't matter.
Oh, and what about the fact that, spoiler alert, but Henry loses his ability to throw fastballs, and he still wins the game. <It's> just... Right. And the game that he wins is not the World Series. I think it's just clinching the division, if I recall. So it just doesn't.
Yeah.
It's so stupid.
Yeah. It's like, we've suspended disbelief this much. Just take us to the World Series, like Game 7. Like, well, I mean. Oh, that's so good.
So, yeah,
I'm glad that made the list.
What do you have for number four?
My number four is Robert Redford's The Natural. Mm-hmm. So. What's interesting about this movie is I didn't grow up on it. And the reason why is because my dad had a level of disdain for this film, which was not the film's fault. Mm-hmm. This is really bizarre, but my dad hated the fact that the trailers for this film showed the scene, the very end scene of the film where he hits the ball and it hits the lights out on the stadium. It's in the trailer. Yeah, and if you look at the trailer, you watch it, you can watch it and you're like, oh, wow. Like, I complain about trailers now, and I think everyone should complain. They give away way too much of movies. I've gotten to the point where I will watch the teaser, mm-hmm. and I won't watch anymore because if I can help it. Because trailers are ruining films, and it's why I love going to, you know, film festivals, is because you don't have to watch a trailer beforehand. You can just go off a one-sentence synopsis and then, you know, just hope for the best. But anyway, my dad would always say, oh, The Natural, like, it was the worst. I hated watching that movie because I knew the whole time watching it, thinking, oh, they haven't knocked out the lights in the stadium yet. They haven't, you know, they haven't knocked out the lights in the stadium. And then the final game, he's like, you know, well, this is probably where it's going to happen. And then it does. And he was just so mad. He was just so upset that, like, growing up as a kid, my dad was just, he would talk about The Natural mm-hmm. as if it was the worst baseball film ever. So by the time I finally get around to watching it, I'm a little bit older. It's an incredible film. Yeah, one of Robert Redford's great mm-hmm. performances. I knew what was going to happen in the end, but that didn't take away that scene, you know, the scene in the, you know, when his manager comes up mm-hmm. and he's like, you're the best damn baseball player, like, suit up, you know.
Well, I'm pretty sure in that final scene before the lights blow up, there's like a 30-second establishing shot of the lights. It's like, that's where he's going to hit it.
Each light gets a few seconds, like each pull. It's like, there's this one, and there's this one. And then it's the establishing shot where it shows all of them, you know? Oh, it's so good. It's so telegraphed. Oh, my gosh.
I've actually only seen the movie one time. I liked it. I need to really go back and watch it again. I do like Robert Redford. Not the biggest fan in the world, but The Natural is a quality flick for sure.
Yeah, loved it.
Timeless.
Yeah. All right, you're number three.
Number three, I have. Oh, The Sandlot. I mean, more needs to be said about The Sandlot? I mean, that is.
So that's my number three as well, by the way. Sweet. So awesome. Yeah, fire away and I'll follow you.
Yeah, so for The Sandlot, this was really, nostalgia sets in. But for this movie, this is a good flick. I mean, the story, the characters, first of all, that's what stands out the most. These kids feel real. I mean, you obviously didn't grow up with these kids, but you feel like you could have. They're real kids, you know? So everything about The Sandlot was just this idealized American city. Probably never existed, like, you know, the way that the story is told, but you want to believe it. I mean, you want to believe that there's this group of kids that go out to play baseball every day, and they're knocking the ball over the fence and running away from neighborhood dogs. And, you know, it's just a really timeless tale. It's so widely understood that it's a great baseball film that you don't really need to describe it. You just say The Sandlot and everyone knows why you love it.
Yeah, everyone knows. No, it's like I don't need to pitch it to anyone because no one's listening to this is thinking, oh, I have never caught that. I've never had the time. No, we've all seen it, right? I mean, I remember even seeing it in theaters with my family. And I like, even at the time, it was like, watching it, I knew, you know, it was one of my favorite movies I had seen at that point. Mm-hmm. And I was just at that age where it was just perfect. Like, the kids were a little bit older than I think, you know, when it came out in 93 or 94. The adventure story is great. You had James Earl Jones in there, which is terrific.
Perfect casting. It was also perfect casting for that.
Yeah. Like you said, the kids, it's so rare for a film to get that many kids that right. From Squints Balladoris or whatever his name is to the ginger kid playing catcher to Smalls to Benjamin Franklin Rodriguez. Yeah. Like, the kid was a leader.
And Timmy and Tommy. And
Timmy and Tommy. It was also served as one of the best anti-chewing tobacco PSAs. Because I can tell you right now, I have never had an interest in even trying chewing tobacco.
Well, you just knew.
Because I don't want to throw up on the roller coaster.
Obviously, they go hand in hand.
I can't not mention the scene where Squints fakes drowning.
Oh, yeah.
Because we all have that lifeguard. We've all wanted to do something like that, right? And the fact that he does it, it's amazing. It really is such a great scene. Yeah, that's number three on my list too. So we got our top twos now. So
all right. So for number two, I have the original Bad News Bears.
Okay. Yeah. You had to specify, so we weren't thinking of the Richard Linklater version. Okay.
Yeah, not my favorite Bad News Bears, the remake. But for this one, this came out in 1976, well before my time. But when I was a kid, I remember watching this movie and thinking, those kids are awesome. I wish that I was playing on that team. When little Kelly Leak, played by Jackie Earle Haley, pulls up on his mini bike, I'm thinking, wow, that kid is my hero. So, you know, and the movie itself is like, obviously they made a remake, but, you know, the original movie, it's timeless. They deal with stuff that you can't exactly deal with today. There's a scene where the kid's drinking beer in the dugout. The coach gives one of the kids his beer, which is awesome. But no, Walter Matthau was the coach. He was fantastic. Little Tatum O'Neal as the girl pitcher. She was great. It's a great cast. The story was, it just really hit home. I played in Little League when I was a kid. My teams were not nearly as cool as these kids, obviously.
I've only seen 10 or 15 minutes of Bad News Bears. Mm-hmm. I actually haven't seen the whole thing. And I love Walter Matthau. And this is one I really need to watch all the way through.
Yeah, definitely.
I wonder, I'm curious if I'm not alone in that, in the whole, you know, it's the type of movie where you circle it and you know about it and you've seen pieces, but you just haven't actually had the moment to sit down and really watch it. So this is good because this should serve as the motivation for both me and others like myself that haven't actually tried.
And I think, unfortunately, it does kind of get forgotten about. I mean, you know, there was the remake with made by Linklater, but it's you can't really compare the movies. I mean, also the Bad News Bears was like the impetus for a lot of so many movies after it, like The Mighty Ducks and Hardball with Keanu Reeves. I mean, even The Little Giants, exactly. I mean, they stole the formula that the Bad News Bears created. So
yeah. Well, it's good to know what the inspiration was for the annexation of Puerto Rico.
Oh, yeah. Wait till we talk about our football movies. Because Little Giants is absolutely going on my list.
How could it not? How could it not? Rick Moranis, thank you. Oh, gosh. So my number two is Moneyball. Mm-hmm. So we're right back there. I'm a huge Oakland A's fan. I'm not old enough to really truly appreciate a World Series victory. Yes, they've won since I've been alive, but not old enough for me to really care. I mean, I remember watching Jose Canseco play as a kid, you know, going to those games, right? But I, you know, the best it got was when I was in high school, and it was these Moneyball years. And my dad and I went to every single playoff game at the Oakland Coliseum. When Moneyball was being made, I was excited to see it. The first trailer hit, I think you shared it on my Facebook wall or something. And it was the first time I had watched the trailer, and it was just like, this movie's made for me. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's scenes in there at the Oakland Coliseum during games that I was at, you know? And it's just like, this is, I could already relive this, Hollywood's version of this, and it wasn't that long ago.
Right.
You know, Scott Hatterberg and the 20-game win streak. I mean, going to those games, being a part of that was some of my favorite, most cherished sports memories. You know, along with the, you know, 2002-2003 Sacramento Kings. You know, some of my favorite sports memories. And so the fact that we had Brad Pitt as Billy Bean that you mentioned, Jonah Hill in a role that at first was like he hadn't really done a serious role before, at least that I remember. And so it was a little bit like, whoa, how's Jonah Hill going to do in this role?
Oh, yeah, I think that was the sentiment that everybody had, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And then you had, I mean, at that point, Chris Pratt was a no-name, and now he's the biggest movie star on the planet.
Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah, that was the one that I was like, that sealed the deal for me, because at the time, he was my favorite actor alive. I mean,
he's
that
my
guy
favorite
was
actor
out
dead.
Film.
So.
Yeah. Really?
No.
Really?
He's dead, but no, he's not my favorite.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, we've been known to make Philip Seymour Hoffman dead jokes on this podcast. So I'm not sure.
So what did you think of his portrayal as Art Howe? Well, being an Ace fan, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, this was certainly from the viewpoint of Billy Bean and not Art Howe.
Because I was going to say, he comes off kind of bad.
Oh, I can't imagine how pissed. I mean, Art Howe has got to be looking at like, hey, Academy Award winner Philip Seymour Hoffman is going to portray me in a movie, and the movie makes me look really bad. I think it's trying to say something generally about the relationship between, you know, the GM and the, you know, and the manager that may or may not be true depending on the clubhouse, to where like one of them is certainly more important than the other. That if you have one of those, if you have someone like Billy Bean that's really good, that it almost marginalizes or doesn't even matter.
Right.
Who's writing the lineup? You know, the batting order.
Well,
but
I think there's a scene in the movie where Art Howe, Philip Seymour Hoffman as Art Howe, he says, "You built this team for me, and so let me manage it." And Billy Bean says, "I didn't build this team for you." He flat out tells him, "Like, this is not your team. Yeah. I built this team."
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I think that was a great little moment.
It was, and it's a really interesting commentary on those positions in baseball, which is kind of what they were getting at. I mean, he plays a curmudgeon. I will say this about the role: as much as I love Philip Seymour Hoffman, I mean, he was underutilized.
Yeah.
But it's not like we were gonna have scenes from Doubt with him and Meryl Streep, where they're just like, you know, going at it.
Which would have been great, actually, I think.
Well, it may be, maybe if you put the priest collar on him and just let him go. But yeah, he you could tell he wanted to play it kind of yeah, I don't know, kind of under the radar mm-hmm. type of performance.
Oh, yeah,
like
I think
he didn't want to be too showy. Because Art Howe isn't exactly a showy personality.
Yeah, I don't really know much about Art Howe. That's the thing. I mean, obviously he's a legend, but I don't know anything about his personality. So I don't know if Hoffman captured that or not.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think he did. But when you know Philip Seymour Hoffman's capable of doing, you know, personalities that are a lot bigger, mm-hmm. you know, it makes you want him to do that, even though it doesn't work because that's not true to Art Howe's personality. But anyway.
Yeah, when I heard that Hoffman was going to play the Howe role, I was like, that seems kind of overkill. Like, why would you put Philip Seymour Hoffman in that role? Whatever. I mean, it worked, but.
Yeah, it's a good question. You really could have used a lot. You could have put in a lot of different mm-hmm. people, and it wouldn't.
Gary Busey.
Brought in a Machine Gun. Yeah. Christopher Lloyd.
you know, one of the things about the movie that I really appreciate as a baseball fan, and I'm a huge baseball fan, is every name in that movie is a real player. Nothing is made up, as far as I know. But even when they're going through the lineup cards and looking at the stats, like, that guy really played in the majors. So I just thought that was a little attention to detail that stood out for me being a baseball fan.
Totally. Totally. I mean, there's certain things that I could have, you know, Miguel Tejada mm-hmm. Played a pretty big role as a player mm-hmm. on that team during those years. And he was 100% marginalized. And you got to cut somewhere.
Well, the thing is, they didn't want to use subtitles. And that really kills your box office.
Well, I mean, I would have. They missed out on all the Dominican Republic money.
Well,
that they could have had.
Well, you know, they would have cast Luis Guzman as Tejada. So yeah, I think they did miss something by leaving him out.
Could you imagine putting Luis Guzman in there and be like, don't even bother watching footage of Miguel Tejada. Just be Luis Guzman in there with a baseball uniform.
Just be Lou. Just do Lou.
Yeah. What I would have loved is if they had put in, like, just to appeal to the Chinese box office, if they just would have put in just grab the biggest Chinese movie star and just pop him in.
Which is what I kind of feel like they did with Million Dollar Arm, but that's a whole different thing.
Oh, that's true. We're going to get to Million Dollar Arm. Ooh, not on my top five, but we will be talking about it. We will be talking about it. But anyway, so Moneyball, love the movie. Mm-hmm.
Good choice. Very good choice.
I really, 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 really love it. And as an A's fan, the biggest critique that both the film and the book get is, well, has it worked? Billy Bean has yet to win the whole show, right? And so I actually disagree with that assessment. I don't think winning the World Series is the mark of, oh, it was a success, or, oh, it wasn't. Like, truthfully, with the exception of this season being a huge exception, this man's managed to take the lowest payroll in baseball and has fielded a contending or a playoff contending team for several years.
Almost a decade. It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, at this point, I think we're beyond the point of saying whether it works or not. Mm-hmm. I think it works. Now, can you win a World Series doing it is what remains to be seen. But you can field a good team.
Oh, yeah.
So,
well, I think it comes down to the playoffs or the postseason. It's so short a time that, you know, you fall victim to the hot streaks and the cold streaks. And you know, sometimes you just... That's the breaks, basically. So
you're a big Dodgers fan.
Huge, yes.
So I've got to imagine the only way you can explain away all of these Giants World Series is by subscribing to my and a very popular thought model of how in baseball all you got to do is make the playoffs and then it's literally anybody's game.
It really
anybody
is.
Can make it to the World Series.
It really is, and it every time the Giants win it. It kills a little bit of my soul. I can't, I don't understand how it happens, but that team, man.
Yeah, well.
What are you going to
do? That ballpark, though, by the way?
Oh, it's beautiful.
Ooh. Oh, it's one of the best.
Yeah.
Oh.
The garlic fries.
I mean, of course, I'd still take... I'd still take the Oakland Coliseum any day, but you know.
Well, you know, the Dodgers played the A's in the Coliseum this year. And if you read, I go on Reddit a lot, and I follow the game day threads of the Dodger fans. And just half the comments were talking about how terrible the stadium was, how the field the field surface itself is massive because we kept popping out into the foul ground. And people were just constantly complaining. Like, in a real stadium, that would have been a foul ball in the stands. I'm like, yeah, that's the Coliseum.
That is the Coliseum. Oh, I can't tell you how many times I've ridden BART up to that station.
Really? Man.
And driven, obviously, right up to the Coliseum. It's just in the worst neighborhood imaginable. Mm-hmm. The worst. Have you even been there? Have you been to a game there?
No, I've never actually been to a game there. I've driven by it. Wow. I never stopped to watch a game.
Okay. Yeah. It's crazy.
I imagine.
But they're trying to build a new one.
Well, good luck with that. With what money, by the way?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Good. Great question. By the way, I'm sure the great taxpaying people of Oakland will foot that bill. Anyway. All right. So we're down to our number ones.
Okay.
Hit us with your number one.
So my number one was Major League.
Whoa.
Yes. 1989 Major League, starring Tom Berenger, Charlie Sheen, Corbin Burnson, and Wesley Snipes. Played a great little role in that. Willie Mays Hayes. So for me, Major League is it's basically the perfect baseball movie. I mean, you have a group of guys that have no business competing, coming together, unifying for this one single goal, and basically achieving greatness because they learn how to play as a team. So for Charlie Sheen is by far, this is his best role. He was perfect for the Ricky Vaughn, the Wild Thing. The movie itself is just, you know, it's kind of silly again, but I think it still holds up. I think it's a movie that I can watch every year, and I try to before the season starts. I try to watch some baseball movies to get me pumped up, and Major League is always on that list.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, again, I have never seen Major League.
Oh, you are missing out, my friend, because it is the perfect baseball movie.
Number one.
Yeah. It's silly. Oh, you know, it's over the top at times. Again, doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the baseball, you know, following rules and whatnot. But you want it to be the Wild Thing. You want it to be Charlie Sheen once you saw that movie. It's like, he was just the coolest. So it's number one.
Wow. Well, you mentioned this is Charlie Sheen's best role. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you haven't watched Two and a Half Men, which is his best stuff.
His best film role.
Oh, okay. Woo. Wow, I was getting ready to correct you.
It's right behind Hot Shots Part Deux, so. Or right above, I should say.
You know what's funny is Charlie Sheen does have like a handful of films where he's like legitimately good and funny. And
yeah, there's no doubt.
And this one's always referenced as one of those. And so I'm glad that made your list, though, because, again, for the same reason as Bad News Bears, is I need motivation to watch it.
Yeah, you should definitely check this one out. He's one of those iconic characters that, you know, sports fans just know. Like, you say The Wild Thing, you say Ricky Vaughn, they're going to know that you're talking about Chuck Sheen. And he was he's really funny in it. There's some great scenes. Bob Uecker plays the play-by-play announcer. I mean, he's hilarious in it. So there's some funny moments, and it's all around just a great baseball movie. It's a must see.
Major League. All right. So
add it to your Netflix queue immediately.
Okay, so my number one film is actually Field of Dreams.
Okay.
Starring Kevin Costner.
Solid choice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not the traditional baseball or sports flick where there's teams that are, you know, up against the gun, trying to make the playoffs, trying to win the championship. Nothing like that. In fact, there's no team aspect at all. It's much more of like a romanticized kind of view on baseball and baseball history, really. I mean, you've got these supernatural elements in it. We got the ghosts of shoeless Joe Jackson, played by the immortal Ray Liotta. Anyway, it's a movie that I certainly have a sentimental connection to, And it's almost sometimes an emotional view for me. Mm-hmm. You know, having a dad that I grew up loving baseball, a grandpa, and then his father. It's a movie about, really largely about, I think, baseball and the dynamic between, you know, some father and son. And,
right.
Something that I can certainly relate to a certain extent. But well,
that's one of the great things about sports in general is, you know, it's something that you can pass down, or something that can be passed down to you, a passion for it, at least, by a father, grandfather, uncle, whatever, or even a mother. And I think Field of Dreams is a perfect example of that in movie form.
Yeah. I love there's like this adventure aspect to it, mm-hmm. Where Kevin Costner's convinced he's crazy, yet he can't, you know, he can't not pursue what these voices are kind of telling him to do. It's really kind of crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, even watching it now. But eventually, you know, and this is another film with James Earl Jones, right?
Right.
Just like The Sandlot.
Yep.
And the scene where he goes and essentially kidnaps James Earl Jones in a way and forces him to go to Fenway with him. But he takes him to Fenway to watch the Oakland A's play the Red Sox.
Mm-hmm.
And we did this, my brothers and I, actually last summer, May of 2014, we took my father out to Boston.
That's
and went to a game at Fenway
awesome.
When it was the A's versus the Red Sox.
I thought you were going to say that you and your brothers kidnapped James Earl Jones. I was going to say, nicely done.
May of 2004, my brothers and I did this. We kidnapped an 87-year-old James Earl Jones. against his will, but thankfully his weak, frail body was no match.
Does he live in a junkyard by any chance? Because I choose to believe he lives in a junkyard with Beast.
Yeah, we were quite surprised when we kind of broke into his apartment that he was blind. That made it a lot easier to get him in the back of our VW bus.
Can you get my baseball for me, by the way? I hit it over the wall.
Yeah, while we're here, do you happen to have a baseball that's signed by the 1922 Yankees? Because that would be... What year is it? What year is the Yankees? Is it 22?
I want to see 27.
27
Yankees? I think it's 27. I don't remember.
I knew I was going to screw up the year.
That's all right.
But we went out to catch a game at Fenway, which is actually my favorite ballpark to experience a game. I've been to two games at Fenway, so not like a lot. But there's a certain... Yeah, I don't know. There's a certain historical... Wrigley Field's also mm-hmm. a great place. But there's a certain historical feel of, like, you know... I don't know, man. It makes me wish... As much as I hate the Yankees, it makes me wish they would have never torn down the old Yankee Stadium.
Exactly.
It just seems so crazy to me because the new one is so, like...
Corporate?
just... Oh, my gosh. Yes. It's, like, sterile. It's just, like, just... It's literally a slab of concrete.
Right, and you know, that stadium, the Red Sox stadium at Fenway, is literally the only thing that I respect about that franchise. So,
yeah.
They can't ever get rid of
it. Well, what's crazy, too, is the seats are just so uncomfortable.
That's what I've heard.
But you don't give a crap because they're the original wooden seats.
Right, like, and I've heard it's really tiny, actually.
It is. The way it's built and the way the people crowd against the baseball mm-hmm. diamond... and really the whole park, it's just like you feel so intimate. It feels like a really, really intimate setting, and you feel close with the people around you, with the players. The cheers and the eruptions are just enormously loud.
Right.
You can feel like the intensity of the fan base is palpable. And it just made for a really enjoyable game. Mm-hmm. It certainly helped that the A's won. You know, we're all decked out in our A's gear. And then of course, you know, anyway, it's a great ballpark, but Field of Dreams is, one of those films that I feel like can pull off what they adding those fantasy elements to baseball. Mm-hmm. It really works. And so that's my number one.
Yeah.
But
well, I think it's a solid choice.
Really, really.
Yeah.
Love the film. Yeah.
I'm not a big Kevin Costner fan, but that is a movie that I can absolutely rewatch.
Me too. I and when it's on TV, I always watch it. Now, I wrote down films that baseball films that I enjoyed, maybe some that I didn't. I'm gonna go through that list quickly.
Yeah, let's hear it.
And then let's go through yours. I did write down A League of Their Own because it's important to note Rosie O'Donnell's most meaningful moment. I should say most meaningful non-Donald Trump moment. And you know, Tom Hanks, Gina Davis. We watched it a lot growing up, but ultimately, I rewatched it recently with Lindsay, and it's still good. I enjoy the movie. I really
do. You know, it's still funny. I mean, it's still it's well crafted. The story's great. I mean, it's a timeless story, really. But it's a really well made film. Funny. There's some really funny lines of dialogue in there. The characters are really strong. The performances are really, really well done. It's a really good movie. I mean, I could definitely watch it again. Not the biggest, personally, I'm not the biggest Tom Hanks fan, but this is one of the movies I liked him in.
Yeah. Not me too. I mean, there's no crying in baseball. It's such a good.
Exactly.
Now, I wrote down also Rookie of the Year. We'd gone over that already. I also wrote down The Rookie with Dennis Quaid because it's worth mentioning. I didn't write it down because it almost made my list, because it did not
my
list. I wrote it down because what that movie did do for me is that it forever changed the way I feel about those speedometers I drive by that tell me how fast I'm going on my car. Because I think to myself every time, maybe I should pull over and just throw a few.
Now, has it ever been verified that it actually works like that? You can throw a baseball past it?
There's no way it works. There's no way. There's no way it works. I can tell you right now, because I would ride my bicycle past them, that didn't really work out super well either. And if my bicycle... if it can't catch my bicycle, I don't think it's
gonna have a tough time with that. No, The Rookie's pretty good. I mean, it's a Disney flick, not one of my favorites.
It's the Remember the Titans, version, I guess, with less racial tensions. But I actually do sometimes enjoy the Disney formula. Mm-hmm. I loved Miracle as a hockey film. Yeah, I don't know how you feel about Miracle.
It's good. But I'm actually a bigger hockey fan than a baseball fan, so. And Miracle is definitely one of the better hockey movies that have come out since Slapshot, really. But Disney-fied.
I mean, Mighty Ducks obviously dominates that conversation.
Honestly, it really does. I mean, that's a nostalgia one for me. It's Bad News Bears on Ice, and it really...
Oh, the Knuckle Puck, man? Come on.
I believe that was Mighty Ducks 2 when they did the Knuckle Puck. Maybe 3.
My lack of knowledge in this area is starting to show.
No, The Rookie's pretty good as far as being on the outside. What'd you think? Did you have a Million Dollar Arm in there? That's another Disney one.
I did. Yeah. Million Dollar Arm is, I think it's too strong to say criminally underseen, but it did not get the love it should have gotten.
No way. It's totally.
I really liked.
Under respected.
Really
that's it. For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
I think that's for me. That's John Hamm's best theatrical role.
Undoubtedly.
He carried the film and he pulled it off to a T. I mean, obviously, you know that he can play the jerk well. But he played the character role. I thought the kids played the Indian kids. I can't remember I don't know the actors' names, but they were great. The little Indian guys, the comic relief, was obviously a highlight.
He was really good.
Yeah, my wife actually loves that movie. I can't tell you the number of times I've come home and that movie is on the television. And I'm like,
really?
Yes, Million Dollar Arm again. And she constantly quotes that little Indian guy. I wish that I knew his name. I'm totally disrespecting him by not giving.
No, I love it. I love it how none of the Indian names. Yeah.
I just don't know his name. But he has some killer lines in that movie. So I'm with you on the Million Dollar Arm thing.
No, I feel like now this might be a real reach in a comparison. Mm-hmm. But I was listening, there's this film critic named Devin Faraci that has this podcast where they talk about films that they think should belong, what belongs in the canon, like the film canon, like this made up film canon. And they,
like
they,
for
they,
genre they, or what are we talking about? Just all
no,
time?
No, they just have one general, all time canon. Like, should this be considered one of the greats, right? And so they'll, him and a co-host will debate it, and then they let the viewership vote, right? So like they did a whole episode on Forrest Gump. It did not make the canon,
it
right?
It shouldn't be.
Then they,
so
then they talk about.
Good choice.
Yeah, then they do Godfather 3. Does that belong in the canon, right? Which is really interesting because it's famously maligned, yet it has this weird group of support that feels like it's better than people think it is. And that's a conversation for a whole nother podcast.
I've actually never seen it, so I can't.
I haven't either. I haven't. I cannot bring myself to watch it.
Same here. Yeah.
Can't do it. I can't. Like, Godfather 1 and 2 are too good.
Perfect.
Like, two of the greatest films of all time.
I would say they're two perfect films. It's very rare, but
when
those
people
were two perfect,
ever,
perfectly
not
made
that
film.
I'm asked this question frequently, but when people ask, like, is there such thing as a perfect film, I reference The Godfather, certainly. And The Godfather, too, could be in that conversation, but I always say The Godfather, to me, is the perfect film. Anyway, yeah, to think Godfather 3, knowing that it's imperfect, even if there's some value in it, I can't do it. So, anyway,
that's the way I feel about Mighty Ducks 3, by the way. The first two were just so perfectly made. You didn't need a third one.
But the reason why I bring up Devin Faraci and that podcast is because they talked about Shawshank Redemption and how it's number one on the IMDb 250 list, right?
Yeah.
Based on user ratings, they have Shawshank Redemption as the number one film. And they talk about why that is, because when it first came out, it was very ho-hum. Got kind of middling to mixed reviews. Mm-hmm. Maybe it leaned on positive, but it certainly wasn't anything that you would ever think would make the number one, you know, IMDb, you know, user rating list, right? And so they talked about the theory, and I bring this up because I feel like this will happen to a much lesser extent, but this will happen to Million Dollar Arm. But their theory was that The Shawshank Redemption has played so much on TNT.
I was going to say TBS, the ubiquity of it. I mean, it was just constantly on television.
It's almost become like people have gotten comfortable. There's something about being comfortable on your own couch at your own place watching it that almost feels like it's a guest in your own home.
Right.
It's like a weird member of the family.
Well, especially the scene where the sisters are trying to rape Andy. Obviously. It's so just comfortable watching that.
I think this is a guest that's welcome in my home. People got so used to watching it, and it's a say what you will about Shawshank Redemption, but it's a rewatchable film.
Right.
I mean, it's got this very feel good ending, you know. Right. It's got some great Morgan Freeman quotes, and I feel like Million Dollar Arm is a film that should, and I hopefully will be played on TV constantly.
Yeah,
because it's very rewatchable, and I feel like maybe my kids will see Million Dollar Arm a ton on TV, and then you know I'll be able to tell them when it came out, it really actually wasn't that big of a deal. People weren't talking about it. Like, it wasn't critically maligned necessarily,
right,
but no one really cared.
No, it was just ignored. And I think that...
Ignored, yeah. Yeah.
It's just unfair because it's a good, solid film. And I think it's going to get better with age, so...
Now, a baseball film, another recent baseball film that I don't think was so solid is 42.
Yes.
I did not like that movie.
I wanted to love it. I'm a Dodger fan. Jackie Robinson, an iconic player who held so much weight beyond the game itself. Yeah. But the treatment was just, I don't know, man. It just fell flat for me.
It did. And it wasn't awful, like top to bottom.
No.
Right?
It wasn't
garbage, but it was flat is the best way.
It's just forgettable. All the characters felt hollow to me. Like every peripheral character. It's like, here's Jackie, and then here's another cardboard cutout.
Yep.
Who's going to enable him to do something. And it's just, it didn't work for me.
No, it didn't. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact is you're taking on subject matter that means something to a lot of people.
Yeah. In that sense, it's impossible, really, to make a film that's going to please everybody.
Right.
So just please me, is what I say.
Yeah.
Make the movie I want to see. Damn it.
Yeah. Pick the movie that me, white baseball fan, millennial, wants to see of Jackie Robinson. I should be the person you're thinking about. No, but the two things I think that they had in this movie, which is a bummer that they ended up blowing it, is they had the subject matter of one of the most important baseball figures, maybe the most important, and then you also had a Harrison Ford that was giving a crap. Now, ultimately, his performance didn't work for me because that voice he did was too over the top.
Yeah.
But the fact is he was trying.
He really was trying.
And
it's the first time we've seen him make an effort since, what, The Fugitive in the 90s? So
yeah, I actually think so. Yeah. I mean, the most meaningful performance recently is the 3 seconds he gives in the Force Awakens trailer, which is seriously the most meaningful.
You're back on the Harrison Ford bandwagon after seeing that.
Yep. Huh? Yep. It's a decade and a half anyway. But the funny thing, last comment on 42 is I crack up at the things that the way people talk about the movie to me. Mm-hmm. It's as if we need to like it.
Oh, okay.
Like we don't have a choice, right? Like people will be like, yeah, so 42, huh? Like, yeah, it's pretty good, huh? I was like, no, not really. Like we should be okay to say that it's not good. Like people, I had mentioned, I was at some family gathering over the weekend, and I'd mentioned I was going to be doing a podcast talking about the top 5 baseball films, and they were asking me what my 5 were. And anyway,
they're like, other than 42, what are your favorite? Yeah, exactly. What are your other top 4 baseball movies?
Exactly. Right. That's exactly. One guy, some in-laws, uncle, some guy I'm not directly related to, is like, well, you know, clearly 42 is number 1, so what's the rest, you know? And it's like, well, hold on, let's talk about this. 42 wasn't a good movie, and we're allowed to say that, okay? Like, we're allowed to say it wasn't a good movie. We wanted it to be good, and it wasn't.
Well, you know, it actually has some good moments, but the whole...
Yeah, there's a couple sequences. Yeah. I think one of them is when he's getting berated.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that's the best scene in the movie.
Yeah, right. There's a couple scenes that are so good, and you wish so badly that the rest of the movie could match that, because then you would have had a really great flick.
Right.
But sequences aren't going to cut it for me on the whole. So, anyway, the other two films I had on my list was Angels in the Outfield, because Joseph Gordon-Levitt got his start somewhere.
That's on my list as well.
And again, Christopher Lloyd
that's immortal. One of those movies.
And then lastly, Hardball. You had references earlier with Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
I love it when you call me Big Papa. I really kind of like that movie. It's sentimental and sad, but I liked Hardball.
Yeah, I got to see it again, because I remember watching it one time, and I was just like, okay, I've seen this many, many times before. But I'm a Keanu fan, so I'll probably watch it again.
Yeah, so it probably, I should have prefaced that with, I've only seen it one time. But
just a one and done.
What did you have? What did you have on your kind of?
So my also rans, I have I did put The Scout, which is Albert Brooks and Brendan Fraser.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, it's not, honestly, it's not really a baseball movie as much as it is like a fish out of water, and it's kind of like a mentor mentee, father son replacement father type of movie. So for that aspect, I mean, Albert Brooks is hilarious. He's a pretty good actor, and I like Brendan Fraser usually. I mean, I'm an Encino Man fan, so I kind of like everything else he does. It's really interesting, and they have a really good dynamic together, so if you get a chance, check that one out. Another one that I had on the list here was The Battered Bastards of Baseball, which is a Netflix documentary. I don't know. Have you seen it?
No.
It's on Netflix, or it was on Netflix. It's a documentary made by Kurt Russell about this independent baseball team that his father owned in the 70s. And it is a fascinating story about this little independent team that nobody respected, and they didn't give the time of day. The MLB hated them. They didn't want anything to do with them, and they tried to force them out of business, essentially. It's a really interesting story. If you get a chance to see it, it's on Netflix. It's a documentary. And it just goes into detail about all these backhanded things that the Major League Baseball did to shut this little team down. And Kurt Russell was a part of it. I mean, he grew up around the team. He actually played baseball, apparently. But yeah, it's a really cool story. It's called The Battered Bastards of Baseball. So check it out.
All right.
And then my last one that I didn't include in my top five, but it really belongs in any top five list, I think, is Baseball, the miniseries by Ken Burns.
It is
incredible. I mean, it's really long and cumbersome. It's like a, it's a 10-part series, and each episode is like an hour and a half. And, but it's so exhaustive and informative that I think everyone that's a baseball fan owes it to themselves to check it out. There's so many just interesting stories and characters, and Ken the way Ken Burns crafts a story is just unlike any other documentarian out there. I mean, he's the best by far. And his treatment of baseball is just it's just beautiful, really. I mean, he takes the history and gives the viewer a lesson, and you really feel like you've learned or lived part of the history. So, Baseball by Ken Burns.
Baseball. Now, that is that, where can you watch it? Is it on Netflix?
I've seen it. I watched it on Netflix, but that was probably 3 years ago at this point.
Okay.
It might even be on PBS's website because it was a PBS show. I don't know. Maybe they charge it, but it's 10 parts. And it goes all the way from the very beginning of baseball, before it was even organized, all the way up until the steroid era. So it's an exhaustive look, and it covers just about all the major players. I mean, it's really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, we don't have a good steroid baseball movie.
No, we don't.
That's bizarre. I mean, we're getting Lance Armstrong, mm-hmm. right? We're getting that treatment,
right?
Which actually looks pretty good.
I haven't seen the trailer, so who's playing Lance Armstrong?
Ben Foster.
Okay, that's pretty good. I like Ben Foster.
Yeah, he actually really looks the part.
Did he fully commit and remove one of his testicles?
yeah. Wow. That was a controversial surgery, but committed.
Well, and there's the concussion movie with the concussion NFL movie.
Yeah. And anytime I can see Will Smith attempt an African accent, I'm in.
I heard you guys talking about one of the last episodes, and I was like, oh, I have to see this. But I still haven't watched it yet. I haven't watched the trailer yet. So.
Oh, you haven't? No. Okay, yeah, watch it.
It sounds awesome, though.
Yeah, watch it. I'm definitely going to see. So the fact that we're getting a concussion era mm-hmm. film about football before we even get a steroid baseball film seems bizarre to me, because I mean, the concussion thing is a huge deal, and you know, right. I guess there's a good story, the big corporation, Roger Goodell, trying to silence the doctor from Africa. But the steroid era marred a league for a period of time and over a certain amount of players that's like unprecedented in really any sport.
Oh yeah. And as a baseball fan, I mean, I'm a little bit older than you, but the steroid era is without a doubt my favorite era of baseball that I've watched.
Of course it is. I mean, yeah, I remember in the sixth grade I was in the sixth grade. We went to this camp out this area in the Sierra Nevadas mountains mm-hmm. called Sly Park. And we'd stay there for a week in the sixth grade. And in the cafeteria, there was this huge whiteboard that had, you know, two columns, and it was Sosa's and Maguire's home run count. And I remember watching Maguire hit number 62. And the our neighbor down the street, he came running over, another big baseball fan, came running over, runs into our house, doesn't even knock, right? Just opens or runs in and jumps into my arms and my brother's arms and my dad. We're all jumping up and down, celebrating Mark Maguire's, you know, beating Roger Maris's home run record mm-hmm. in a single season. And it was just this moment of like, none of us here are Cardinals fans. None of us here are. I mean, I guess we liked Mark Maguire when he played in the A's, but that really had nothing to do with our cheering. We were cheering for a moment in baseball history.
Well, I can think of one reason why you guys cheered for him, but that's for a different show.
I've been robbed of that joy twice, right? Yeah. Once when Barry Bonds retook the but when it came out that every one of these people, every one of them was cheating, it just took out this not even the wind out of the sails that figure of speech doesn't even do it justice.
Right now,
just this like, oh man, we believe, but like, this mattered to us. Yes. You know?
Absolutely. For me, once all the steroid stuff came out, it was just like, oh, okay. So they're just humans after all. Because at the time, you know, I worshiped those guys. I really did. I looked up to them and I wanted to be like them. And I mean, I didn't want to take steroids, but other than that, you know, it's like they were my heroes. And I thought they were superheroes, basically, real life superheroes. Yeah. And, you know, just to have all the stuff come out afterwards, it's really disappointing. I don't blame the guys for taking steroids. You know,
it's hard to, isn't it?
With what was on the line, why wouldn't you?
It's hard to.
Yeah. So I understand why they did it. I don't know, man. It was such a fun time. And, you know, it wasn't just the offensive stuff, too. I mean, you had guys like Randy Johnson and Roger Clemens and Pedro, Greg Maddux. All of those guys were just unreal. So that was my favorite era of baseball, without a doubt.
Wow. Yeah. So, well, we need a movie about it.
Oh, yeah. That's such a great point. And I wonder if someone isn't working on a movie, a steroids movie.
You got to figure, certainly there's at least 10,000 script treatments, right? I mean,
I would hope that they don't center it around Barry Bonds, because he is easily the most hateable, non-relatable baseball star in history.
Yeah, it needs to be around Roger Clemens. And that's
my favorite Roger Clemens moment. World Series, I think it's 2002, maybe. He's Mike Piazza hits a chopper back to him, breaks his bat, and Clemens throws the bat at Mike Piazza as he's walking to first. Like, yes, that's roid rage. Yeah. Oh. No, Clemens was a hero of mine, without a doubt.
Totally.
Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah, the Rocket, man. I mean, he was...
I remember as a kid, I wanted to be a pitcher. I'm not a pitcher. I can't throw hard at all. But I bought this baseball that was a Roger Clemens baseball. And it had these little finger markings on there. This is how you throw a fastball. This is how you throw a curveball. So, unfortunately, it didn't come with a syringe and or any of the clearer cream. So
this is how you really throw a baseball. Exactly.
Little did I know.
See, for me, it's Jason Giambi for a little bit later.
Not
but
Jeremy.
Still, no, Jeremy. Isn't that amazing that Jeremy would come out the better Giambi?
More respected, that's for sure. Yeah. And do you think it was a slap in the face that Jason didn't make it into Moneyball?
Oh, yeah, totally. Oh, man. You know that Jeremy holds that over his head, right? Like, ugh. Well, let's wrap this up because this sucker is going to be close to an hour and a half.
All right. Maybe you can edit, you can cut out some of the fat. So.
Yeah. You know what? I'm going to do that. Let me go ahead and listen through an hour and a half of this and let me cut the fat out. I'm going to keep it in most of it. But the first 5 minutes is going to get cut, but that's bad.
All right.
That's because we weren't even having officially started the pod. But hey man, I do want to say thanks for joining us. Undoubtedly, we'll have you back on.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I really appreciate the chance. It's been a pleasure. And thanks, Skyler. I appreciate you getting out of the way.
Our next pod should be next pod will be Skyler and I.
Boo.
Moving forward, Skyler will be also wearing his Make America Great Again hat that he got from the Donald Trump store. Which is awesome that he's been wearing. He wore that on Friday as a social experiment, which is amazing.
So actually, I do have one plug. Can I do a plug here at the end?
Absolutely.
Okay. So my brother runs a t-shirt company and he makes these really cool horror themed t-shirts. So if you do like horror and you're into that kind of stuff, go to dawnofthethread.com. That's DAWN of the thread.com. You can find them on Instagram
Dawn
as well.
Of the thread. You know what? I forgot to mention MoviePass. Dang it. Skyler's he's usually good about reminding
me. Just wedge it in there somewhere, making it obvious.
Well, I do want to say thank you to MoviePass
for Thanks,
sponsoring
guys.
This podcast. But I'll mention the show notes as well. And this episode's brought to you by dawnofthethread.com.
Thanks.
So www.dawnofthethread.com.
That's right. And you can find him on Instagram with the same name, Dawn of the Thread.
Okay. Perfect. I'll add it in. And is it horror films?
Yeah. So it's horror. It's based off of horror movies, imagery, stuff like that. And it's like, it's a lot of playful stuff as well. So it's like Photoshops and, you know, it's fun stuff.
Tell me is there one based on The Shining?
You know, I think that's one of the ideas he's working on. He has The Shining. Cool. He has, a lot of like Twilight Zone as well. Friday the 13th, It, stuff like that. So.
Perfect.
Big movie, big horror movie buff.
Awesome. Well, all right. We will sign off. Your first episode also broke the record for the longest episode. So, congratulations.
They call me the marathon man, so thank you.
You know what? You got to participate in the tradition, how we end our pods. So, as we say,
hold on to your butts.
Well done.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, man. All right.
Thank you for listening to the Brave Little Podcast. Hold on to your butts.